Okay, so a few years ago, Angela and I had this sort of recurring disagreement, we'll say. And it's going to sound really silly when I tell you, but we had this big argument about what kind of shoes she would wear out. And you got to understand, not because of like a difference in fashion opinion or something like that. I don't understand how that's possible to like walk on for, that's like a calf burn right there, just trying. So, you know, all respect in the world to be able to walk in some of the shoes that look so uncomfortable. But it wasn't a fashion thing, but with her, it led to like, if she wore what I called naughty shoes, it would lead to like 2 days of her not being able to walk because of the damage it would do to her feet. Because at this point, we didn't know what was wrong with her feet. She had some. They thought she had stress fractures. They thought maybe she had needed to use orthotics, and she just had some issues with her arches. They actually thought she had reflex sympathetic disorder for a while. And they were doing nerve blocks, and they actually did a biopsy on her foot. Like, they tried everything. 11 different doctors trying to figure out what was wrong with her shoes, or excuse me, her feet. And for me, I'm like, well, the one thing that we guarantee will make you not be able to walk tomorrow is wearing the wrong type of shoe. So in my mind, I'm like, you should be rocking like the classic Keds or Skechers or whatever, like basic white or black flat Gelin, like Magellan or whatever goes inside with those inserts, and like whatever, like, you know, pillow on, you know, in a sole that you can wear. Who cares what it looks like? And I'll get the point, like, who are you trying to impress besides me? If I'm okay with those nursing shoes, then just wear them. Who cares? And so we got into some of the biggest arguments in our young marriage at that point over naughty shoes. Because she'd come around the corner, or worse, I'd meet her somewhere, and she had been like a full day into the naughty shoes. And she didn't walk like this, but I don't know what that walk was. But she had those big shoes on, and I'd be like, what are you doing? Why are you wearing those? And I mean, I would get so upset because I'm like, you can control that. Why would you intentionally do something that's going to hurt you later all just to look cute? You already are cute. You'd be cute with like the little whatever, just the strength shoes or the wide areas in the front or whatever they are. Like, it doesn't matter. She looked cute in a walking cast. It didn't matter what she wore to me. But these explosions that we would have, these big arguments where she's like, I don't care. I mean, she'd be crying and I'd have a bag of shoes. I'd have them over my shoulder ready to go throw them away. Like, it got intense because I was like, I don't know what else to do to protect you from yourself over what shoes you're wearing. It just seems so silly to me. But my explosions or my anger and those big arguments we had, it wasn't really about the shoes. It was fear. I was afraid. I was afraid of what was going on with my wife. I was afraid that she was 22 years old and struggled with walking already. And so for me, one of the ways that fear manifests itself in my life is control. I have to try to control her so that I feel better about her situation and I could do my very best to protect her from herself. So even though it felt like this ongoing argument, I was just against her. You know, as I look back, at the time, I was like, well, baby, it's because I love you that I want you to, you know, not wear these shoes. But I look back now and I'm like, I was so afraid. Fear was what was driving those outbursts. It's amazing now that I'm a parent, I understand more some of the explosions of my teenage years, or actually, probably more accurately, the explosions aimed at my older sister during my teenage years. Because I sort of watched her from afar go through all of the gauntlet of mistakes to make as a teenager, and then I sort of laid back and kind of came through with a lesser standard in general, which was kind of nice for me. But it didn't mean I still didn't have my moments. But as I'd watched my parents erupt at her for breaking curfew or for saying she was going to be one place and being another, you know, all that stuff would happen, and I'd be like, man, Mom and Dad, take it easy. She was 5 minutes late. And they'd be so angry and they throw groundings at her. You got to break up with this person. You got to stop this, whatever. And it was, you know, I understood the point of it. I understood where they were at. But at the same time, they were also struggling with fear. When they say to be home at a certain time and you're not, as a parent, you're freaking out. Where are they? And this was pre-cell phone days. So now it's a little different. Now there's actually an app on your iPhone, if you have one, called Find My iPhone. If you don't know about this already, this might change everything for you. But as long as anyone's on your iTunes account with the same password, so family account, any device can be tracked on your phone. So it's like boop, 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 shows it driving, shows it moving. We use it most often because it's also a way to locate your phone because it plays a beep. So, you know, I'm not saying which of us loses our phone more often. I'm just going to say that we use it quite a bit as a family. And so it's like someone will say generically, hey, can you just push that button and beep my phone so I can find it? And so that's a great simple feature, but it also puts the phone on the map. So if that was around when my sister was growing up, it might have been a different story, who knows. But now you've got a little more control and a little more ways to kind of track each other. But I know for me, a lot, did someone just do it?
Yeah.
I hear it beeping. Well done, whoever did that, nice timing. That's the Find My iPhone beep. That's awesome. Either that's the biggest coincidence ever or someone is. Kevin Chambers, I don't see your face right now. I feel like you're somehow the culprit of this. He disappeared behind that screen and his face is nice and red now. Well played, okay. So if you wondered how it sounded, that's how it sounds. Even if it's on vibrate, it's pretty incredible. Anyway, we'll keep going. But oftentimes behind the explosion of anger, behind the outburst of some sort, sometimes it's not really about that. There's something deeper at play. But this happens in other areas as well, where I remember when I was a young adult pastor, and it was a large young adult group. You know, by the time we left that ministry, it was between 500 and 600 on a Sunday night just for college and young adults. And so sometimes parents would call me and be like, will you please call and invite my kid to come? They won't come if I tell them, but maybe they'll come if you do. I'm like, man, I thought I grew out of this when I left student ministry, which parents were always asking me that back then. So I'd be like, well, what do they say about the young adult group? Why don't they want to come? I'd say, well, they say it's clicky. They say no one wants to talk to them and stuff. And they say that no one... I'm like, okay, so let's break that down. How is it clicky? If they're a first-time visitor, like, are people friendly to them? Well, yeah, people say hi and stuff, but they just don't feel like they're in after the first 20 minutes. I'm like, well, you have to understand that, like, we're human beings, and we naturally talk to people that we know. It's not at the exclusion of a visitor. If they feel friendly and welcome, that's great. But if we all just talk to the room, it would be chaos. Imagine if we walked in, we're like, hello, everyone, how are you doing? It's good to be here. How was your weekend? Mine was great, awesome. Hey, nice hair, nice shirt, nice shoes, naughty shoes. Angela, you're in trouble. Whatever it was in that moment, we don't do that. We don't talk. We talk to people. So I'd talk the parents through this and be like, you know, that's your child using an excuse to cover the real reason. They're afraid to risk. They're afraid to step into a new space. They have flashbacks to the junior high lunchroom where they walked in with their tray and they looked for a seat on that fateful day and nobody moved over. Or they had a Forrest Gump flashback where the seat was taken all over the bus or whatever it may be. That excuse is something they're saying because there's a deeper fear behind it that they won't be accepted. Oftentimes, so much of our outbursts, so much of our excuses, so much of our reasons, so much of our even our opinionated ways or our grumpiness or sometimes the meanness that we have, it's all a mask. It's all the outworking of fear, just in different ways, in different settings. Paul, in Acts chapter 18, you'd think if anyone had the right to battle fear, it would be Paul. How many times have we seen him during this series in the book of Acts go into a city, start preaching, start selling tents, and then all of a sudden the people get mad at him, they get a little mob, they drag him out, and they either beat him or throw him out of town or scold him or whip him. It's happening over and over and over again. Every time God leads him to a new place, you gotta be thinking in the back of your mind, I hope it doesn't happen again. It's happened like 5 times in a row. Can I just go somewhere and have success? It's funny, even when he goes to Berea, he goes and he starts to have success and people are receiving it. Even then, Silas and Timothy are able to stay behind and have this great ministry and Paul's got to go by himself to Athens. So last week we looked at him in Athens by himself and debating and presenting his viewpoint in a very exclusive philosophical circle called the Areopagus, where he presented the gospel in a specific way to that group. Well, after that happens, he leaves there, and God leads him from Athens to the city of Corinth. So today we're going to get some of the kind of the seeds of the church at Corinth that we'll read about so much later in the New Testament. But Corinth is about 50 miles west of Athens. And Paul leaves. He went to Athens on his own, and he leaves Athens on his own and arrives in Corinth by himself. And it's amazing how Paul sort of set up like kind of a method when he gets somewhere. He gets there, he right away usually gets in a synagogue and starts to preach and teach. He sets up his tent-making station in the Agora and starts selling and making tents to provide a living for himself. He develops relationships in the community, gets some followers, and if he's there long enough, he disciples them and leads them and becomes a little church and kind of pours into them for a while before he's run out of town violently. So let's see what happens in Acts chapter 18. Acts chapter 18, verse 1. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. And he went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for they were tent makers by trade. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and tried to persuade the Jews and Greeks. This is kind of amazing. So he gets there this time, and he finds this couple. And it's like, boy, you ever meet somebody that you're like, oh my goodness, we have so much in common with them. It's incredible. I mean, here he is. They're from Rome. So probably Roman citizens. They were sent out of Rome by Emperor Claudius. He expelled many Jews at this time. Not only were they Romans from Rome, so Paul was like speaking their language and understanding their cultural sensitivities, but they were Jewish, Paul was as well, and so they understood the balance of both worlds. And then furthermore, what did they do for a living? They made tents. They even did the same thing. So, I mean, Paul's got to be loving this couple, Priscilla and Aquila. Connects with them, and he stays with them, and even sets up his shop to sell tents and make tents with them in the Agora marketplace. So he's got his relationships with some people, he's staying with them, he's got his business set up and rolling, and now he heads into the synagogue in verse 4. He reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and tried to persuade both Jews and Greeks. So again, he's by himself at this point though, no other companions, like no more Silas and Timothy at this point. They finally arrive in verse 5. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word, testifying to the Jews that the Christ was Jesus, or Jesus was the Messiah. And when they opposed and reviled him, he shook out his garments and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." So let me just pause there for a second. So in this moment, he has spent all this time, he's in the synagogue, he's reasoning, he's debating, and finally the opposition arises, and the Jewish people that are there start to not only revile him, which is insult him, or not only oppose him, but also to revile him, to insult him, to threaten him, and to sort of start to bring the tension to the room. Now typically, Paul handles this differently than he does here. He basically, in this story, blows his top. He loses it. He completely goes ballistic in the middle of the synagogue. I mean, like in my mind, when I think of a cartoon, like where a character just like goes from toes to the top of their head, like just red comes up like mercury and steam comes out of the ears and the head comes off and it's like, what? You know, like the eyes have swirls in them. I think I just pictured something from Tom and Jerry possibly. We'll see. Maybe you have a different one to think about. But anyway, just think of him absolutely getting so fed up, so annoyed, so frustrated, so burnt out, so angry, so rageful that in this moment he just loses it. And he's not outside. He's in the middle of a setting kind of like this. He's in a synagogue and people are saying stuff and they're insulting, they're mocking him, and he says to them some pretty intense things. First thing he does as he takes his garment and he shakes it out. Now, this wouldn't really have much meaning today. Like if in the middle of a message, someone was chit-chatting in the back, and I was like, oh, I can't believe this keeps happening. And I took off my outer shirt, okay? I still have an undershirt on. Let's keep the mental image good here. And then I take my shirt and I just start waving it. I'm not sure that's going to have, like, people are going to be very confused by that action. Be like, is he bringing an airplane in for a landing? Like, what's he, is he signaling surrender? Like, what is he? But here, if you took your garment and you went like this and shook it out, remember when Jesus told the disciples, if someone doesn't receive you, shake the dust off your feet, for it'll be better for Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for that town. It's this idea of bringing a curse upon them. It's saying that what he just says to them right after is saying, you know what, I'm done with you. Whatever happens to you is going to happen to you, and it's going to be bad. I am done with you. I'm shaking it out. Get the dust off your feet. I don't want any part of you. And then he gets even more specific. He says, your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles. So here he's citing a passage in Ezekiel where Ezekiel talks about a watchman on the wall of a city. And if the watchman sees the enemy coming and he turns and he tells everyone, the enemy's coming, get ready for battle or you're going to die. And nobody gets ready, nobody responds. And they all get killed in a battle. That watchman was not responsible for that. He did his part. He told them of impending danger and nobody acted. Therefore, he was innocent of their blood. He's citing that and saying, I'm telling you about Jesus. I'm telling you about the gospel. I am telling you what it takes to be saved, but I'm done now. I'm shaking off the dust of this garment. I am telling you the blood is on your own heads now, and I'm innocent. I am absolved. Do what you want with this, but I'm out of here. And then he says, I'm going to the Gentiles. He'd never said it like this before. In the beginning, he says he was talking about Jews and Greeks. He's saying, I'm done with you, Jewish people. I'm finished. I'm going to the Gentiles. And then he proves it. Look what he does. Verse 7, it says, and he left there and went to the house of a man named Titus Justus, a worshiper of God. His house was next door to the synagogue. Wow. So he walks out. He says, I'm done with you. Whatever you decide, I don't care. I'm done. I'm going to the Gentiles. Then he walks outside and goes and knocks on the parsonage door, Dave Gray's house. Ding, 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 ding. Hey, will you, Titus Justus, let's start a church. Let's do it. Literally next door to the synagogue. Now, the synagogue would have been in a downtown area. Expensive real estate where that was. To have the house right next to it, commentators, historians, scholars believe that Titus Justus would have been definitely one of the benefactors of that synagogue. He would have been very wealthy, been very influential to have a house right there. So he doesn't just go to anyone. He goes next door to a big hitter in town. He gives his life to Christ. And then, who does he lead to Christ next? You want to talk about controversy? Verse 8, Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord, together with his entire household, and many of the Corinthians, hearing Paul, believed and were baptized. So the next guy who went next door and gave his life to Christ, Crispus, the guy who was the ruler of the entire synagogue that he had just stormed out of. Imagine this little church he's starting in Titus Justus's house. He's got this wealthy benefactor and a powerful, influential, wealthy, connected religious figure in the Jewish community there has just walked away from Judaism, given his life to Christ, and went to church next door. You want to talk about tension? And they weren't meeting in the basement with the windows shut, whispering with candlelight. You know, Paul is there. He's continuing to preach loudly. So they're right next to the synagogue, preaching an opposite message for the most part. And so people, it says that people kept hearing from Paul, and many Corinthians were giving their lives to Christ. But here's what's amazing. So you look at that story and say, Paul had enough. He was frustrated. He was hurting. He blew his top. He went outside, started a church right next door. And it seemed like God was using him and God was blessing it in some ways. People were coming to Christ. Here's what I think is amazing, is that in the midst of that, Jesus appears to Paul to encourage him. And listen to what Jesus says right out of the gates. Look at verse 9. And the Lord, this is Jesus here, and the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, do not be afraid. Afraid. Isn't that interesting? He doesn't say, stop being so mad, stop being frustrated, stop raging, stop being divisive, stop starting this other thing, stop doing this other stuff. He says, do not be afraid. So what's amazing is Jesus cuts all through our actions. He cuts through our masks. He cuts through everything, and he gets right to the core issue. And the core issue with Paul was fear. Fear. Why? Why would Paul be afraid in this moment? Has this happened before at other locations? where he's teaching and he's reasoning and he's leading, all of a sudden people start to oppose him. It's like Paul could sniff this violence a mile away. And he had it. He's done. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm done with you. I'm out of here. You die, I don't care. I'm going next door. I'm getting out of here. At least the Gentiles don't always try and kill me, although they did once. Jesus cuts through all of that and says, do not be afraid. For those of us who have battled fear in our lives, to say that you and I are in good company in the Bible is an understatement. Do not be afraid is used in the Bible just about 70 times. And the list of people that are told directly by God, by an angel, or something else, the list of those people is like a who's who of our faith. Abraham, Joshua, Moses, Jacob, Gideon, the disciples, John the Baptist. The list goes on and on and on. All of them had to be reassured, do not be afraid. And what usually followed that was, for I am with you. That's Joshua 1:9. In that whole passage in Joshua 1, here's Joshua succeeding Moses. Can you imagine? That's a tough, it was tough enough for me to succeed this man here at this church. 40 years in this area, incredible ministry, incredible impact. I walk in his shoes, you know, I try to carry on his legacy, and that's a weight that I carry. Now, we're blessed that he's still here in every possible way. So it would be like Joshua succeeding Moses, but Moses still being kind of in his crew. That's not how it worked out for Joshua. He was gone. So Joshua's going, and God looks at Joshua, and he says, do not be afraid, for I am with you. Then he says, be strong and courageous, because you're not alone. I'm with you. I love that picture. So here he is saying to Paul, Jesus appears to him in the middle of this outburst. He started this church. And Jesus says to him, do not be afraid. Keep on speaking. Keep on preaching. Do not be silent. Which is amazing because Paul, it says he was still teaching. But what Jesus is showing us here is that there was something going on in Paul's heart where he was thinking about being done. He was thinking about getting out of town. He was thinking about, you know what? I just don't want to talk about this anymore. Like Jeremiah, I'd like to stop talking now, but I can't. It's like a fire shut up in my bones. He says, keep on talking. Keep on preaching. Do not be silent. For I am with you, verse 10, and no one will attack you to harm you. For I have many in this city who are my people. I love that. Paul, in this moment, even though Silas and Timothy have arrived, Paul is battling fears of feeling alone. And I love it. He says, I'm with you. You're not alone. And I will protect you. No one will attack you to harm you. Meaning, like, he's not saying people won't want to beat him up, because that's pretty much a constant. He's saying they're not going to be able to harm you. No physical harm is going to come to you in this moment of your life. So I love that. Another thing Paul was struggling with, another thing Paul was afraid of, was that he was going to be physically beaten again. Jesus addresses that, goes right into the center of his fear. And then this last part is awesome. He says, for I have many in this city who are my people. Now, this has been dissected a lot because they're like, wait, no, Corinth was a secular city. He'd only led a few to Christ at this point. Why would Jesus say to him, I have many in this city? Was there some secret faction somewhere? No, it's not. It's believed that this was not a statement of the present, but this was Jesus making a promise about the future. In other words, he's saying, no harm's going to come to you. I have many people in the city. What he's saying is, through you, Paul, I'm going to use you to reach many people in this city. He's telling Paul what's going to happen in Corinth. Jesus knows the future. We don't. That's such a huge part of our fear, is that we don't know what's going to happen. And Jesus gives him a glimpse. He says, don't stop talking. Don't be afraid. No harm is going to come to you. I'm not going to let you get physically harmed. That's a future statement and a promise. Then he says, for there are many people. I have many people in this city. That's a future statement. He's saying, through your work here, Paul, many are going to come to Christ. What comes to mind here for me is, remember the argument, sort of, that Moses had with God at the burning bush, Exodus 3? God comes to this murderer at that point. You know, so in your mind, Christian Bale has done, no, I'm just kidding. Charlton Heston, of course. No, just Moses himself. Forget about the movies. Moses at this point has killed a man. He's been hiding and tending sheep in Midian for 40 plus years. And God appears to him in this burning bush and tells him to go back to the scene of the crime, literally, and go tell Pharaoh to let my people go. Moses is like, I've got a speech impediment. I can't do this. Can you pick someone else? I'm not sure I'm the right guy. I don't think, you know, just excuse after excuse. I love when he says I have a speech impediment. God's like, who do you think gave you that speech impediment, pal? Do you think I can't take it away as easy as I gave it to you? But what I like to think about, and I know that there's an argument to be made that God could have used someone else. But what if Moses really hadn't done that? God promised him things were going to happen, that he was going to lead people out. So he trusted in the future promise of God, and that gave him the courage to stand in the face of fear and opposition. What if Moses had said, no, I'm done. I'm wiping my hands. I'm shaking out my garment. Your blood's on your own hands, Israelites. I'm out of here. Think about what would have missed out. And this same language, the same imagery is being drawn upon to Paul by Jesus saying, Paul, keep on preaching. Don't be afraid. I'm with you. You're not alone. I'm going to protect you. And guess what? There are many people in this city that are going to come to me through your ministry. Don't leave. Isn't that incredible? He's saying that there's a future for you here, and I'm going to bless your ministry. Just don't go. Don't be afraid. I'm with you. Stay the course. I'm going to bless you in this place. It's amazing because Paul believed Jesus. And he trusted him. He stayed for 18 more months. At the end of the chapter, you've got the opposers get unified. It says in the text, there's a unified attack against Paul, and they grab him, and they take him in front of the new proconsul in Achaia, who they had hoped, even though he was the brother-in-law of Seneca, who was the mentor to Nero, so they should have maybe connected some dots that he wouldn't be super sympathetic to the Jewish people, but anyway, they tried it anyway, and they dragged Paul in front of him and said, he's breaking the law, he's telling people to worship someone other than Caesar, he's a rabble-rouser, he's a rebel, he's outlaw, all that stuff, and he just, as Paul's about ready to defend himself, Gallio shuts him down, says, this is not my problem, this is yours. Get out of my sight. And then in an ironic twist, normally, even when Paul was absolved, he still got a beating, usually, right? Even when they're like, he didn't do anything wrong, but give him a beating anyway. That happens a lot to him. Yet in this story, it says that the new ruler of the synagogue who replaced Crispus, the new ruler of the synagogue who was trying to make a name for himself 18 months after his predecessor had left to follow Paul, this guy brings charges against Paul. They're dismissed, and then the crowd beats him in front of Paul. That's a weird twist, isn't it? I'm not saying that Paul got some strange joy out of that, but Jesus certainly honored his promise, didn't he? They're going to want to harm you, but they're not going to. I'm going to protect you, Paul. Keep preaching. Don't stop talking. I am with you. I'm going to protect you. And there are people in this city who need to hear the gospel. Stay. I don't know where you were this week. I know for me, fear was a very real opponent for me this week. Just to share something so that you guys can just be praying, but you know, Angel's had a lot of pain lately, and so we took her in to kind of get looked at, and there's a possibility of something that they have to a fairly significant operation that they would have to do, which would help with some pain, but it's a big deal. And they have to do an MRI to confirm it, but just be praying. It would be awesome if she went in that MRI tube and they found nothing. That would be awesome. But for me, I look at the future and I don't know it. And I look at what this would mean for a 36-year-old woman with two little girls. And I don't know about you, but I start to get anxious and I start to get fearful and I start to get nervous and I start to wonder how it's all going to work out. And yet I serve a God who has repeatedly come through. We serve a God who, this has happened before in different areas, and he's always been faithful. So I stand before you today wishing I could say that I don't battle fear, but I do. I wish I could say that I wholeheartedly trust the one who knows the future. But in certain cases, I don't. And it's amazing to see how he gives us promises and how he tells us, above all else, the thing that stuck out to me the most in his promise to Paul was, I am with you. Just even right there, just like when Moses says, well, who should I tell him sent me? God says, I am sent you. Jesus says to Paul, I am with you. The same God who led Moses out of Egypt miraculously, the same God who protected Paul when he was dragged in front of the proconsul and they wanted to beat him and maybe kill him, the same God who 69 other times in the Bible told people to do not be afraid, for he is with them. That same God says to you and to me today, do not be afraid, for I am with you. He offers us hope. He offers us comfort. He offers us peace in the midst of anxiety. And I think for me, one of the ways one of the ways fear kind of comes out of me or manifests is a desire for control. If I can control it, then maybe I can keep it from being bad. I won't ask anyone else to raise your hands if you connect with that. But there are certain moments where there's literally nothing I can do. It's completely out of my hands. And in those moments, if I don't turn to God, then I'm overcome and overwhelmed with powerlessness, with anxiety, with worry, and most of all with fear. So God tells us to not be afraid, to trust him. He's with us. And what I love at the end for Paul, it's saying, there's many people in this town, there are many in this city that are my people. He's saying, Paul, I've got a purpose for you in being here. Stay the course. Don't be afraid. I'm going to use you. So my encouragement to you today, because of the blood of Jesus Christ, because he died on the cross for our sins and rose on the third day from the grave, he offers us life in his name, freedom from sin and from death and from shame and freedom from fear. We do not have to be controlled by fear anymore because Jesus defeated it. His perfect love drives out fear. So my prayer for you and for me today is that we would trust him. Trust the one who knows. And don't waste another minute fretting and worrying about the unknown.